Welcome to the Secrets in the City podcast, where we turn secrets of our past into lifelong lessons. My name is Dr. Catherine Nisko, and I'm the proud host of this podcast series. I love science, and I love how it can help people. So when I'm not interviewing incredible individuals here on Secrets in the City, I spend my time creating and delivering science-based programs that help people and teams perform at their best. Because in my experience, understanding the science of why we do what we do is the quickest way to change what we do. You know it's going to be a good episode when your guest starts out with, "Nothing is off limits with me, so ask away." This podcast is juicy, honest, and full of inspirational tools on how to treat ourselves with kindness and care. So if you're feeling burnt out, low on energy, and are treating your body like a garbage bin rather than a place of respect, you're in the right place. On that note, before we get into things, it's important to let you know that we're going to be talking about a few intense topics, including disordered eating and sexual intimacy. So please take care, and if there are little ears around, best to listen in using earbuds. My next guest is a dear friend from Sydney, Australia, who recently visited Perth on holidays and was ever so kind enough to stop by my office to record this episode. Today, you'll be listening to the wise, the wonderful, the new nutritionist, Lindy Cohen. Her story is one I wholeheartedly relate to, which is, I think, why this discussion is so passionate, authentic, and real. And we talk about our shared experiences living through decades of disordered eating and hatred of our appearance.
I resonate with this so much because I've been someone who's eaten my emotions, and I think so many of us women can relate to this.
And if you've ever felt like you just can't stop that urge to have just one more bite, you're going to learn how to slow down the devil in the dopamine, a chemical known to prompt unhealthy urges, so you can ultimately create a happy mind and a happy body.
You want to binge at that moment. Once it's gotten to that point, you're kind of too far gone. And if you do emotionally, it's going to happen. I think what we can start to do is just, let's try and understand it.
But what I know you're going to love the most is when Lindy gets truly naked. And I mean truly buck naked.
And it's completely naked.
What?
Yeah.
What?
So that was my reaction when I found out.
Now, let's head on over to the interview and listen to the buttery voice of Lindy Cohen. So you ready?
Let's do it.
I'm just so excited about this episode. So, Lindy, what secret do you choose?
Oh, okay. I choose this one. I eat my emotions and hate myself and my body for it. I haven't let my husband touch me for over a year as I don't feel sexy. Oh, it's good, huh?
It's juicy.
Let's dig into it.
I'm just gonna sit back and listen to you because I know that you are just going to be a barrel full of information. So why'd you pick this one? I mean, there's literally thousands of secrets. Why this one?
Yeah. I mean, firstly, I resonate with this so much because I've been someone who's eaten my emotions. And I think so many of us women can relate to this idea of, something good or bad happens in our life. And we come home and we eat or we're in the car. We go through a drive-through and we smash as much food as we can. And I think part of this really leads to this idea of when we're growing up, we celebrate with food. So you have birthday cake. So that's one little moment that connects food to emotion. But we also mourn with food. So when bad things happen, it's kind of something that we do to make ourselves feel better. Mm. Maybe it's a Friday afternoon and your parent would say to you, "Here's a little treat for you. Well done. You do well. You get food. You behave. You're going to get food." And so we're constantly connecting food with emotion. So it's so naturally tied in. Plus, as humans, physiologically, when we eat something, we're going to get a whole bunch of those sweet little hormones going to get released that's going to endorse us to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's protective, ultimately. And that's the thing I think we've got to realize, that when we are going to eat and we're led to eat more than we think we should, it's actually our body's way of trying to protect us. And, you know, especially with binge eating, which is when you feel really out of control around food, your body's trying to protect you. So normally with binge eating, it's when you don't allow yourself to eat enough food, your body gets fearful that there's a famine, a perceived famine, and it won't let you starve. Your body loves you. Your body's got your back. So it kind of overrides your self-control and it feeds you. And I think that's kind of a cool thing to kind of take away. Well, maybe me eating my emotions isn't about me being out of control. Maybe it's about my body trying to protect me. And maybe I got to work out what's actually happening here. Mm-hmm. What I think is so interesting about this is how emotional eating, which is something that's often very secretive. You know, we don't talk about it. You know, we all kind of do it, but it's somehow shameful because we assume it's something wrong with us. It's like, I have poor willpower, or I'm just, you know, everyone else has such good self-control, but I have bad self-control. And that's nonsense, because you can't actually rely on self-control to be healthy, firstly. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happens is, our perception of willpower when it comes to food is very warped. So let's say, for example, you go out throughout the whole day and you're really on top of it. And there are multiple opportunities throughout the day where you could, you know, lose control around food, but you don't. But then you get to the end of the day, you're depleted. And this one moment where you do, you give into that craving, you perceive your willpower as being really low. But let's say you had a day where you had to achieve some work, so write something, do something for university, whatever it is. You could have multiple opportunities to do it during the day, provided that there's only one opportunity that you do achieve it, you now perceive your willpower as being great. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to food, we really just give ourselves a really hard time. We beat ourselves up. And all that does is it promotes more emotional eating. What I think this is very interesting about this secret as well is how it ties into intimacy and sex and relationships, and how emotional eating, binge eating, it ties into everything in our lives, and how body image limits us. It keeps us small. It keeps us.
Isn't that ironical that it keeps us small, yet we feel so large?
Funny. Yeah, and our brain is just filled with nonsense. So you actually can't live a big life. When these are the thoughts rolling in your head, let's say you're going to bed at night, you're going, oh, how many calories did I have? How many points? How many macros? Whatever nonsense you're counting at this time. What do I weigh? You know, weighing yourself up in your mind. You actually can't live a big life because your brain is just filled with this nonsense. Yeah, so what I think is so interesting about this secret is that it's secrecy and it's all tied into our entire lives, and so we don't talk about it, we don't get help for it, and we especially don't talk about it with our partners. Mm-hmm. Because often what we do when we're trying to be healthy is we recruit our partners to try and help us. So now they become the food police. They say things like, oh, should you really be eating that? Or they'll make comments in an attempt to help you, because maybe once you previously did ask for help. Except now all that does is reinforces the idea that you shouldn't be eating something. So now all that ends up happening is when you are alone, when no one else can see you, that's when the emotional eating often happens. And so we have this really vicious cycle. And I think the first thing you got to do to get out of it is to, hey, I'm an emotional eater. Nothing bad about it. I promise you, I speak to women all the time who are emotional eaters, and probably about once a year I meet a unicorn who doesn't emotional eat. And she is an exception to the rule. So it's nothing to be ashamed of.
Absolutely. And that story resonated with me so much, because I remember, this is years ago, dating someone, and I was constantly trying to lose weight. And the irony of trying to lose weight while you're trying to stop binging is it's like trying to put two of the same ends of a battery together. They just don't fit. It's like oil and water. So I would ask him to be a food police, but I really didn't want that. And I love peanut butter. And for me, toast was basically just a vehicle to get peanut butter into my gob. So it would be like a tiny bit of bread and then about 3 inches of peanut butter. And I was making myself a piece of toast, and he said, well, how are you going to lose weight with that amount of peanut butter? And in my head, I knew he was right, but I literally wanted to punch him in the balls at that second in time.
But you didn't.
I didn't. Mm. I gave him a scowling face, and then I proceeded to eat two, then three pieces of toast, just to give him the, you know, the mental middle finger.
Well, that's the way it goes, isn't it?
Yeah.
The more you think I shouldn't be eating something, the more you are going to end up eating it. I'm even surprised you put the peanut butter on toast. Normally, it's peanut butter straight from the jar on a teaspoon, and these are one of the foods that people often overeat. So, bread, peanut butter, cereal, ice cream, lollies, chocolate, but even things that are, you know, stereotypically healthy, mm-hmm. like yogurt and fruits and vegetables. These can all be foods that we end up emotional eating, because as soon as you believe I'm not allowed to eat it, it gets a higher reward in your brain, which means more happiness is released when you do eventually eat it. And I think what we have to acknowledge is there is joy to be had when you get to the end of the day and you allow yourself to do the emotional eating thing. Yeah. So it's like you're wiping something clean. It's just you. You might be watching TV. In fact, you're often watching TV when this happens. And it's such a disconnect, a way of numbing. And it's just another form of trying to control our emotions, trying to self-soothe. And I think if you want to let go of the emotional eating, firstly, you got to acknowledge what you might be missing out once you let go of it, a bit of a joyful experience. And what are we going to swap that with?
Mm-hmm. We're all just, the devil is in the dopamine, I say. You know, we're all just dopamine. We want things. We have this full body craving for it. And it almost feels like our life is dependent on having that food. We get into this sort of stress tunnel vision. And it's like because I am very public with the fact that I used to be a very severe binge eater. And I remember trying to describe it to someone and say that there could be, and this is going to sound horrible, but like a burning child under a bus that needs saving. But I was so focused on the food that I had to eat that food. It was like nothing else mattered other than that food. And even just saying that out loud, you think, that's ridiculous. Of course you would be able to get out of your own mind and see what's actually important. No, it is like heroin for a heroin addict. Nothing else matters.
I totally agree with that. Once you're in that mindset, once that flip has switched, you're there. And I hear a lot of advice about how to stop emotional eating. And people are like, hey, when you feel the urges come on, see if you can go for a walk or something.
Or drink water.
Yeah, drink water or chew gum or, meditate. And I'm like, this is coming from someone who hasn't obviously had any binge or emotional eating, because that just ain't happening. You want to binge at that moment. Once it's gotten to that point, you're kind of too far gone. And when, if you do emotionally, it's going to happen. I think what we can start to do is just instead of feeling guilty, beating yourself up that you're emotional eating or binging, let's try and understand it. So each binge, each emotional eating episode is an opportunity to learn a little bit more about why it's happening. So once you've done it, try work out, all right, well, why is this happening? Which foods triggered me? Was there an emotion that triggered me? Was I watching TV? What's my environment doing? Mm-hmm. And just start learning. So you're not going to ever stop emotional eating, when I was binge eating, multiple times a day.
Me too.
So the way that it reduced is maybe I'd only have one binge a day, and that was success. And then maybe it was only a few binges a week. And this takes a really long time. And eventually it was 6 months since I'd had my last binge. I think what's really important is that we can't go and look at our, we can't, if we binge, which is an inevitable part of the process, it's not failure. You didn't fail. This isn't you having to start all over again. This is part of the process. All you're going to notice is that you start doing it less and less and less. Mm-hmm. And that's success. So I think when you're learning to stop emotional eating, you gotta cut yourself some slack. The very reason we're emotional eating in the first place is because you're holding a lot of really high standards for yourself about what you shouldn't be eating. And chances are you're very stressed. And if you had a nutritionist and a personal chef and personal assistant and a whole lot of lovely people in your life helping you, maybe you could just use willpower to get over emotional eating. But we lovely people live in the real world, so we got to make a plan that doesn't involve willpower.
Absolutely. And I think that whole concept of being easy on yourself to stop binging, that's a hard one for people to latch on to, because part of the reason, and I say part because there's so many, it's multifactorial, part of the reason why we're binging is because of the shame loop. I feel shame, therefore I binge. I binge, therefore I feel shameful. So we're caught in between this sort of ping pong match of shameful emotions and binging. So to get out of it, it reminds me of this quote, the curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. But man, is that friggin' hard to do.
Ooh, it's big. It's a big one to ask of us.
Huge. massive. Well, and especially, I think it's also age dependent. You know, we're, you know, let's say above, I don't even know how old you are.
I'm 31.
Okay, 31.
Yeah.
I'm 42.
Cool.
I think as we get older, I think this gets easier because we start, I think our mind opens up to different things that are important to us. When we're younger, would you not say that body image is so incredibly important?
I'd say it's probably one of the most important things because it's how you're perceived. You don't really have much income at that point. You're kind of like you're perceived in your looks, and you know, we expect youthful people to be attractive. That's kind of like this perception we have.
Yeah. So how do we do this? How do we accept ourselves just as we are so we can change? If you're, for example, 20 and you want to be a peacock, you know, going around a bar and getting attention, you're getting external validation. Mm. How do you do that?
Oh, it's a big one. I think we have this idea, if I lose weight, then I will accept my body. And I always think about this thing where, have you ever taken a photo or seen a photo of yourself from like a few years back?
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, ooh, she's looking good. Who is that fine lady?
Wow, we were.
Ooh, look at me. And yet you remember at the time feeling so insecure and crappy about your body and just hating on yourself. And you think, shit, why?
Mm.
And now look at me here and maybe my body doesn't look the way it did. And I'm still hating my body. Well, that's proof that you don't need to lose weight to accept your body. If, you know, you're not going to just suddenly like your body when you get back to that weight because you didn't like it at that weight. And to be honest, no matter how much weight you've lost, you've probably kept, you know, just pushing the goalposts out further and further and further. So it's a big ask. But I think there are so many things we need to do to learn to accept ourselves as we are. One of the things that I do that's pretty big is I'm really good at reminding myself that, you know, it's not my purpose to look good from every angle. Like, you know, in that moment where you're walking past some shops, you see a reflection of yourself and you go, oh, shit, is that what I look like? And then I'm like, you know what, Lindy, you don't have to look good from every angle. You're fine. You're good. Take a bad photo. Not my life purpose. My life purpose is so much bigger than that. Mm. And so I'm just constantly reminding myself. And my husband does that as well. I've kind of, you know, recruited him. He's like, you know what, Lindy, you don't have to look, you know, perfect all the time. Just have these sweet little reminders, social media, what you allow into your life, but also the people in your life. So if you've got mates and they are constantly trying to lose weight or dieting, or maybe they've got eating disorders that, you know, the kind of undercurrents, I think we get very influenced by those people in our lives. So you just got to check out all those influences and see, all right, can I make some changes here?
Mm-hmm.
Also, get rid of your skinny jeans. I mean, the jeans that you only wear when you feel skinny, those are the ones I'm talking about. You know, I gave birth 4 months ago and I'm much bigger than I was before I gave birth. And you know what I've done? All the clothes that I had pre-baby, they have been popped into boxes. They've been at the top of my closet. I can't see them. And I bought myself new clothes because I don't need to go into my wardrobe every day and struggle to get dressed. That doesn't bring me joy. That doesn't make me feel confident. It doesn't make me feel sexy. And so it was really important so I could say, well, what's the point of spending all this money on a new wardrobe? I have a whole bunch of different sizes in my wardrobe for the fact that my body is constantly changing. Mm-hmm. Your body's not meant to stay the same size for your entire life. It's just simply not. Your hairstyle doesn't stay the same.
Thank God.
Oh, I know. But your body certainly doesn't have to, and it's going to go through different metamorphoses, and it's important to allow it to do that. So I know a lot of people are like, oh, I want to get back to the body I had when I was in high school. Well, to be
good
honest,
luck.
Yeah, you probably weren't the happiest. I don't know. Like, why do we hold high school as this happy time in our lives?
I hated high school time.
And I hated my body in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't love it then either. So what am I trying to get back to?
So it sounds to me, perhaps one of the things for people to consider is, how do you prime your environment for more healthful adoption into a more purpose-filled life rather than a bum and booty and waist and skinny jeans kind of life? How do you prime your social media? How do you prime your closet? How do you prime the people around you that those can be catalysts for a more positive mindset?
Yeah, and it's all of these things that you got to kind of like bring them together, because if you just do one, dieting and trying to lose weight and trying to look perfect, it's very compelling. It's very alluring and it's going to suck you in. multiple times because, you know, it's just the message we've been sold. If you weigh less, you're happier, you know. Mm. And so unless you create an environment that's actually supporting yourself to like yourself, then I don't think we're going to get there. This thing I've been mulling over recently is this, the contrast between fitness and health. And
oh, let's go. Oof. Let's dive into this one, honey.
So fitness is look like this, and it's very rarely healthy. It's eat the same things every single day. Here's a meal plan. This is what your body's meant to look like. You're meant to go to the gym. You're meant to do these reps. You're meant to wear those little matchy outfits that everyone wears.
Mm-hmm.
And so often fitness means that you do really shitty things to your body,
mm-hmm.
really unhealthy things, and you forfeit your health to be fit or do the fitness thing. And yet when people look at, you know, what's a healthy body, we look at someone on like a fitness magazine, even though the very things required to look like that are very unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Health, on the other side, is about waking up with energy and going to sleep not thinking about how many calories you ate. It's about getting dressed in the morning and finding a way to make it easy and effortless. It's having, you know, falling asleep and having great quality sleep,
mm-hmm.
energy to do the things you love. Like, it's actually got nothing to do with what you weigh. And I think we've got to separate those two because they're not the same thing. So what I strive for, and I've got to keep reminding myself of it, is it's got to be healthy. Mm-hmm. And I don't need to exercise, over-exercise like I used to do or under-eat like I used to do. I just got to find my little sweet spot. And my healthy weight at the moment is different from the healthy weight it was before I had a baby. And instead of trying to control my weight, I live a healthy life. And I'm just curious, where is this sweet little body of mine going to go when I'm living a healthy life that feels good? Mm. So often we get these habits and we do them for the wrong reasons. We do them to lose weight. And so when the weight doesn't come off, or it doesn't come off quick enough, or we regain some of the weight, we forfeit that healthy habit. So our incentive for doing things is really important. And I always say, you got to find the enjoyment zone. If you're not in the enjoyment zone, like, give it up. The only key to consistency in health, and consistency is the key, my friends, is to find enjoyable things, things you actually like doing. So if you can say, I'm happy to do this for the rest of my life, then that's the habit I want you to adopt. So maybe I don't want to go for a run. I hate running, but I do like walking my dogs. Well, then go there. Yes, you're not going to burn as many calories, you know, technically by going for a walk, but it's far more enjoyable. Therefore, you're more consistent. Therefore, the outcome is going to be so much better. If you can't maintain any of these healthy habits, even if you do lose weight, you're going to regain it plus more. That's what we know from statistics. So don't bother. Just get those sweet little healthy habits once you find enjoyable and add them in bit by bit by bit by bit.
Happy mind, healthy body.
Mm, yes.
Reminds me, I was on an interview, I can't remember, a radio interview, and this guy was incessantly asking me, what is the best exercise to lose weight? And I kept on telling him, what do you enjoy doing? And he was like, just tell me what I need to do. And so he was just badgering me on it. And at the time, I was really addicted to pole dancing. Like, pole dancing was life. And I said, well, you know, to be honest, it's pole dancing. And he said, well, I don't want to pole dance. And I said, well, you asked me. Like, he just wasn't putting the two and two together. And I think it's so challenging for people to understand that to be healthy, you don't need a gym membership. And I've come from a European background, and for, you know, my family, especially after meals, we would go for a walk, or, you know, we would do things like that. Now, I got sucked into the whole, you know, modern day idea of fitness, which is a gym membership, clocking in, clocking out, high intensity training and so forth. And there was many aspects of it that I loved. I loved the challenge of it. And I think that's an important thing to bring up, is I think people are seeking healthy challenges. Like, I find that from a day-to-day basis, I'm constantly wanting to stump myself, to try to say, I want to get this. And I think that's missing with fitness. It's just very repetitive. It's very robotic. Whereas I think from an athletic point of view, they're like, okay, I've just run a six minute. Okay, now I want to do a 5:50 split. You know, I think people need those incentives. They need that dopamine for the motivation to say, yes, I've achieved that. What can I do next?
Yeah, it's tangible and it's fun. I think about the parallel in the nutrition world is when someone would say to me, can you give me the perfect day on a plate?
Oh, man.
And I'm like, it doesn't exist. I could, yes. Yeah, so I could work out, you know, which nutrients specifically you need. But if you ate the same thing every single day, which many people in the fitness world do, mm-hmm. it's deeply unhealthy. So just to diverge a little bit into the gut health and gut health, I mean, we affect so many things from weight to immunity to your mood. We know this. So if you eat the exact same thing every single day, you're limiting how many different gut bugs can live in your gut. Now, if some pathogen, some issue came your way, those little gut bugs, they're going to fight them off. So when you are giving them food, if you're only eating the same kinds of food, they only have certain foods to eat, which means you only get a certain number of them. When you eat a variety of foods, you can create we can foster such a different, varied environment of gut bugs, way more than you possibly could if you're eating the exact same thing, which means you've got way more opportunity to ward off different illnesses, right? So what we've created in the fitness world is gut bugs that resemble like a farmland with a few crops. And what I want you to do is have a rainforest in your gut, a whole lot of different gut bugs. So the healthiest diet is the one where you don't eat the same thing every day. So we're always constantly varying it. And you know, the Japanese are the ones who came up with this idea of eating different plant-based foods in a week. So, you know, however many you can get, 10, 20, mm-hmm. 50 different plant-based foods. And the more plant-based foods you can get, the better your gut health and all those like beautiful little flow-on effects. But yeah. There's no such thing as perfect eating. There's no such thing as perfect exercise. It's the stuff that you enjoy. It's having fun with it all.
So there's no way that we can't dive into irritable bowel syndrome, because binging and IBS, man, they're like a match made in hell. I was going to say heaven, but definitely in hell. Because yes. There's direct correlations, you know, research has shown this. Have you, you know, where has IBS come up with everything that you do with your diet, nutrition work?
Well, the problem is when you have IBS, there are certain foods that are going to trigger you, mm-hmm. right? To have these symptoms that are really yucky, uncomfortable, mm-hmm. things you don't want to happen. So you have a list of foods you ought not to eat. And this can often trigger binge eating as well. Mm-hmm. So it fuels the fire. And now, you know, not only do you have secrecy behind the binging, you've got a whole raft of unpleasant symptoms. So you beat yourself up even more. You restrict even harder. You go more intense. And I think it's a really big issue. So you might then go see someone who goes, oh, well, you shouldn't be eating these foods, you know, like an IBS specialist. Mm-hmm. And you go, well, I know. Still doesn't mean I'm not doing it though. And so it's almost like what we need to do is relax a little bit. With IBS and IBD, there is always a threshold with how much food you can have. And what we got to try to do is find your own little personal threshold. Mm-hmm. And so it's often not like I can't have any of that food. And so you'd be better off including a little bit of those foods and creating permissibility around them. So you're like, hey, they're allowed, especially trying to eat them when you're with other people. So much of binge eating is such a secret thing. So we're like, oh, I shouldn't be eating this food. So once you start eating it in front of other people, you're like, hey, this is very much allowed. You bring it into your diet and then it stops having that allure and that appeal. And this is whether you have IBS or IBD. Or anyone. This is just mm-hmm. a smart thing to do. So what I often say is create a list of those foods you often binge on or emotionally eat on. And now very likely these are the very foods that you've taken out of your life. We need to reintroduce them. We need to show that these are normal foods. They are allowed. Once your body trusts, anytime I want to eat, anytime I want these foods, I am allowed. It stops going into that panic mode of I've been restricted, and that's when you can feel relaxed around food. So we have a reintroduction of just normalizing these foods so your body can trust you again, and then it feels calm. They did some really interesting research about if you feed someone the same foods again and again, they kind of get kind of boring. Mm-hmm. But if I said to you, you're not allowed to have macaroni and cheese, and then, you know, suddenly I leave you in the room with macaroni and cheese, you know, highly interesting. So basically, mm-hmm. we want to take these highly interesting foods and we want to make them less interesting mm-hmm. by allowing yourself to eat them.
I remember the study from 1978, and they came up with this thing called the what the hell effect. You know, I've had one sip of something, so what the hell, I'm going to eat everything. And they essentially were comparing two groups, restrictive eaters versus non-restrictive eaters. And essentially the synopsis or the summary of this study was, if you restrict your eating, you're going to eat 10 times as much. If you say, I'm allowed anything, you're going to eat only until you're essentially satiated, until you're feel comfortable.
And isn't it funny? Because we think, all right, well, if I give myself permission to eat everything, I won't be able to stop eating. Mm. But the irony is, when you don't allow yourself, that's when you can't control yourself. So giving yourself permission has the opposite effect. I know it's counterintuitive, but that's the way it works.
Mm-hmm. When I was going through my recovery, I remember my recovery lasted a good 2 decades. And this is where I think some of the benefit of social media does come in, because I felt so incredibly alone. I felt like I was the only person doing this, as you mentioned before. So social media can drive that connection that way. I didn't have that back then. And I remember going to a psychologist as part of my master's program, and she said, just eat. And I'm like, are you smoking crack? That will never, ever happen. And she kept on saying, the more you introduce foods and the more full you feel, the more you permit yourself to eat stuff, the less you will binge. But for me, she could have been speaking alien. It didn't make any sense to me whatsoever. I think connection is so incredibly important, to have connection, like you were saying, to be able to eat those foods in front of people that know about your predicament and that understand that, but from a very empathetic point of view. Mm. The reason why I say empathetic is because I've had other people in my life help me with it, but not from an empathetic or understanding point of view. Because you know that feeling when you're eating something that is on your no list, and then there's someone at the table looking at you, waiting for you to just burst out into tears, and it just makes everything worse.
Oh, I'm glad you brought the conversation here. So, so often, as I mentioned before, we have these people in our lives who we may have recruited to help us. And so they chime in and they're trying to help and they think they're doing well. And sometimes we didn't ask them to help us. It's often mums.
We're going down that road. Okay, let's do it.
It's deep. It's our mums who, you know what? Probably their mums commented on their weight and commented on their food. And their mums commented on their weight and their food. So what we've been doing for generations, we've been passing down disordered eating, and it's damaging. And you know what the cool thing is? It kind of stops with our generation.
Mm-hmm.
You listening to this right now, you can kind of go, all right, this is, we're done. We're done. We don't want to do this. I'm not going to pass this on to any other young women that I know. But when we have these people in our lives who are commenting on our weight, commenting on our bodies, I believe until we have the conversations that we need to have to draw a very clear barrier around these kinds of conversations, then we can't really move forward, because we always have someone who's going to be triggering us, and we feel judged, we feel shame, we feel guilt, all these things that we know are going to trigger us to go into an eating hole, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to have hard conversations. And for myself, I had to have lots of hard conversations in my family, with friends, with people who were trying to help me. I went to my first nutritionist when I was 11 years old and got told, wow, I had a perfectly healthy body. But I appreciated that she said, I can see you're well within the healthy weight range, whatever that means, but well within it. But you probably want to be skinny. So if you do, this is what you need to do. And my family were really on board. And so for the next decade, whenever we'd have spaghetti bolognese, I'd get carrot noodles and everyone else would have spaghetti. And I've got 2 older brothers, and of course the boys could eat whatever they wanted, but I always had special food. And so what was actually, I was this normal kid and really normal appetite, and we basically created an eating disorder out of something. We created weight issues by giving me this complex about things I wasn't allowed to eat. So if you have someone in your life, maybe it's a partner, maybe this is, you know, this relates to the secret about you don't want your husband to see you because, you know, think he has some judgments around what body should look like or what your body should look like or what it used to look like. Or maybe it's a mother or an auntie or a sister or even a best friend. We got to have conversations with them. So some language might be, hey, I know you think you're helping me when you say these things, but actually it makes it harder for me to eat healthily. And I really, really would appreciate if you stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to tell you this, you can have that conversation and they're going to forget you had that conversation, and you're going to have that conversation again. So next time they make a comment, you go, hey, we've already spoken about this. When you make these comments, it makes it hard. I really, really mean it. I need you to stop. Please don't make them again. And so you can't just have the one conversation and expect they're going to stop lifetime habit. Mm-hmm. You need to set that boundary and you got to keep reaffirming it.
Having those conversations though, mm-hmm. I still remember, I think I was 23 at the time. And this is when I was like exercise fanatic, but I was also starting that binge cycle. And I remember turning to my then best friend at the time, and without saying her name, I said, you know, I need to open up about something. I binge eat when I'm stressed. And the funny thing is she said, oh my God, I do it too. And I always describe it as like, you know, you're both holding on in really uncomfortable farts and you both just let them rip at the same time. And I was like, oh, we feel so much better. But chances are they might not be ready to open up and they might all of a sudden go into a very defensive mode or whatever the case may be. So how can we, if we do open up and they perhaps look at us in a certain way, how do you guide people through that?
Oh, that's a hard and heavy one. Mm. So often when someone else is making comments about your food or your body, It's their shtick. It's their issue with food and body that they're kind of putting onto you. So almost when you see the anguish in their face and the hate in their face, you can kind of go, that's all about them. That's all about how they're relating to their body and they're just making it my problem. But yeah, what I find very interesting is it's often the people who are the most judgmental about other people's bodies who are the most insecure about themselves. So I think very interesting. I wish you could kind of encourage someone like your mom to be like, hey, can you just check in with your own relationship with your body and work on that before you make comments on me? But I don't know if that's going to happen. Try having a conversation. Good luck. But one of the things we can do if you do want to learn to accept your body more, and I'm digressing a bit, is to get curious about how you judge other people's bodies. So when you're walking on the street, what are the things I'm guessing about other people? First, work to reduce your judgments of other people's bodies. And what you're going to find is that actually comes and breeds into your life. You know, you can reduce your judgments about everyone and everything. Or even just get curious, what am I judging people about? It's probably the very things you're insecure about. So now let's mirror that back. These people in your life who are making comments about your body, their issues. And so you got to stand strong. You got to accept that you're going to upset people. And I know we hate upsetting people. We love people to like us and you know, think we're wonderful. But it's either you're sacrificing yourself or you're going to just sacrifice their happiness for a fleeting moment. Mm-hmm. No, I think you got to take yourself.
I remember doing a poll about would you rather be liked than respected? And it was really interesting because everyone, a majority said liked, because if I'm liked, then people will respect me. I'm like,
No, it doesn't work like that.
Does not work that way.
And just to check in, that was a poll with females, correct? Because I reckon men, they'd be voting that they want to be respected.
Mm-hmm. And that's shown in the literature, you know, that it's kind of coming back to confidence. You know, if you apply for a job, guys will be like, oh, if there's 5 out of 10 traits that I sort of tick off, I can apply for that job. If a female has 9 out of 10, they'll still be reluctant to apply because they don't have 100%. Mm. And I think this gets back to all or none eating, all or none body image. I'm either look the way I want to look like or I don't. I either eat exactly how I should, which is never good enough because the carrot always is dangled a bit further, or I fail. And that's coming back to that what the hell effect. If I don't have an absolute perfect day and keep within the caloric threshold, I remember downloading apps and it had that traffic light system. It was like my life was great if it was in green. When it hit yellow, like it was like
catastrophe.
It was like an apocalypse was coming. I was like, my life is about to end. God forbid if it went to red, it was literally like death was upon me.
Mm. And it's life-altering stuff, like it controls you. I think that healthy enough really is good enough. And I think that, you know, I was talking about this fitness world, it doesn't have acceptance for imperfection. And so this is an example is people often say to me, salad dressing is really fattening. you know, salad dressing, so much sugar, so much fat, so fattening. And I say, I've never met a person who struggles with their weight because they eat too much salad dressing. Have you? I haven't met one. I'm still waiting. You know, or like you can relate it to anything, like tomato sauce. Yes, tomato sauce has a bit of sugar in it. So what? It's not our problem. Pickles have salt. They have sugar, whatever. You're not going to get overweight from having like tons and tons of pickles. So I think what we often do is we go, well, if it has a little bit of something, you know, quote unquote bad, we have to avoid it. But think about salad dressing. It's something that makes eating vegetables, which is, we know it's good for us. We got to do more of that. Makes it actually tasty. And if you remove the salad dressing, you have a sad, sad salad. And no one wants to spend their life eating sad salads. Mm-hmm. So what we do when we go into this perfect mindset, we go, oh, I can't have salad dressing because it's got sugar and it's got fat and I've got to go for the light stuff and eat it on the side and other nonsense. Or when I have a salad, well, I can't have too much stuff in it because it's fattening. I've got to have, you know, no cheese, no avocado, no protein. I've got to skip bread altogether. So we remove all the things that actually make us want to be healthy. And so we find it really hard to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think what we got to do is find that sweet spot of being healthy enough. And what does that look like? For me, it means I eat chocolate every day because I don't want to live my life not eating chocolate. That's just how I am, or pasta or bread. I'm a lover of these things. And so I have a little bit of, you know, those Lindt chocolate flakes in my coffee every morning.
Yeah,
it makes me so happy. Why would I remove that? and then, you know, I'm finding ways to include the yumminess into my day. And it keeps me healthy enough and it keeps me sane and it keeps me, you know, quote unquote, on track because I'm never cutting out these things. So that's my advice to anyone. You actually got to do things that you consider are less healthy, and it's going to make you healthier.
Yeah. It's
crazy.
It's a paradox. It's an absolute paradox. And do you think if we are happier when it comes to the question of intimacy, because we all know when we're, you know, during our monthly cycle, it's kind of like the feeling of going to a buffet wearing Spanx. Like, it's just an uncomfortable part of the monthly process. So we have that. And then if we also, on top of that, have body image issues, and then we have a partner that, you know, wants to be intimate, it's like we have to almost get motivated. It's like a psych up to, like, win a championship. Like, in before a championship game, we got to psych ourselves up. And I don't know about you, but I've heard stories, everything from, I can't take off my t-shirt, he's not allowed to touch me from the waist up. You know, I've talked about the FUP. Have you ever heard of a FUP?
Oh,
fat upper pussy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, it's basically between your belly button and your... There's a little bump.
Oh, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah. So there's a little spot. So it's basically, that's a line that you're not allowed to look up. Like, there's certain spots that you're not allowed to touch. There's certain angles that you're only allowed to do it that way, not that way. It's all of a sudden very regimented. So the question is it really intimate if it's so regimented?
I mean, sadly, no, but at the same time, yes. Why do we have to create such high standards for what it's meant to be like?
Maybe it's intimate enough.
Yeah, maybe it's intimate enough. And maybe you just got to take it little step by step. And after having a baby, my sex drive is not where it used to be. And I think I used to, you know, in a way, have an expectation of how much I should be having sex to have a close, intimate relationship. I'm kind of just changing that a little bit. Because when you're overtired, you don't feel very sexy. You don't feel like having sex, and then you really, as you said, got to psych yourself up for it. But sex itself creates the intimacy, so it's a paradox. We're all about paradoxes today. Kat, what do you think? What do you think's a good strategy here to kind of rebuild that intimacy to kind of feeling like you can be a bit more exposed?
It's multifactorial. I think there's so many different things at play here, because if you have body image issues, that's one thing. Then there's the age difference. You know, obviously, as you get older, you have less drive for sex, and that's hormone related. It could be also, depending on your religion, after children, maybe it's not, you know, whatever the case may be. I think it's so incredibly couple specific that I think discussions have to be had we also, I think, have to understand that we have different cycles in our life. So most of us are not millionaires that live on a beautiful, you know, Bahamas island where we have everything tended to us. Stress comes into play. How does stress affect our sex lives? That's a question. So how can we come at our intimacy, our levels of intimacy with a curiosity mindset? What works for us? What affects our sexual relationship? And how do we make it, how do we take ownership that's good for us? So it's hard to say, like, I know what works for my partner and I. It's going to be different from anyone else.
Mm. You know? I kind of love the five love languages kind of concept, because I'm always thinking, well, what's my partner's love language and what's mine? And
so what are yours?
Well, mine's touch, and it doesn't have to be sexual, you know, it's just touch, but you know, holding a hand or like hand on a shoulder, those kinds of things. And so for me, that's a way to create intimacy in my world. For him, it's spending time together. So, you know, creating nice little moments where we're doing something together. So you can create intimacy in ways that don't involve sex, while you're kind of on this pathway to learning to accept yourself more. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of could be a really nice goal to have, to kind of feel more comfortable while you're having sex. And, you know, you could start to do the things to do to learn to accept your body more, from changing your entire environment. It's, you know, all those things that we talked about. It's a good goal to have.
Absolutely. So maybe now that we're on the topic of sex, are you ready to reveal perhaps something intimate about yourself? And maybe something, I mean, we've already sort of delved into your life in regards to it, because it's, I mean, I think everyone at this point understands that both you and I have had a very strong relationship with disordered eating in the past, especially binge eating. But can you tell us something perhaps maybe a bit more intimate from your point of view?
So in 2018, I lived in Berlin. Husband got a job, called me one day saying, we got to move to Berlin. 2 weeks later, I live in Berlin. Never part of my game plan, my life plan. But there I was in this city of Germans. And I don't know if you know Berlin, it's very alternative. And it's kind of fabulous. I love Berlin. But one of the things they have there is a sauna. And it's very much in the German culture to go to sauna.
Yes.
Sauna is co-ed and it's completely naked.
What?
Yeah.
What?
So that was my reaction when I found out that this is the situation. But I, you know what? My husband was really keen to go. And I guess I'm prudish. It made me realize maybe I'm prudish, because I'm Australian, Canadian, Americans, UK. I think we think similarly. We're like, wow, where is the underwear? And then I spoke to some of my German friends there and they said, no, it's very normal for us. So they said that one of my friends said when it was his 18th birthday, he had friends over, men and women, boys and girls really, and everyone had naked sauna and it was non-sexual. And then I spoke to another friend and she says, yes, of course, this is very normal in Germany. Well, you can go into the sauna naked with your grandparents, your brothers, your sisters, your dad, and it's non-sexual. So, all right, I'm interested. I don't know many people in Berlin, so I thought, let's go. And you go to these saunas and there's multiple saunas and all ages and all people. And I went and I found it so liberating, because everyone's naked and you realize, firstly, the human body in itself is not sexual. It's just a body. And you realize everyone's body is so different and unique. And what if we could just be naked and be ourselves and not have to feel like we are, I don't know, someone sexual? And you know, you could be in a room with a guy the exact same age as you, who's very attractive, and not think it's a sexual situation. And what blew my mind the most is how chilled I felt about my body. I thought I'd go in there and everyone's going to be looking at my bits and my bobs and this thing that's wrong. None of that. No one cared. No, everyone was indifferent to my body and I was indifferent to my body as a result. And so what I think was liberating about the German culture is they have an acceptance of body. They have because you grow up in a world where you're constantly seeing bodies that are imperfect because you see them in the real life, you learn that that's what bodies look like. But for us, we never have that. You know, we think that, you know, you have to segregate men and women for saunas and you have to wear clothing when you do. And, you know, our version of bodies comes from social media or TV or magazines, so you never get to see that real life. And studies confirm that, you know, the Europeans and the Germans have much better body image than we do. And I would say it's partly because of this naked, knackered sauna culture. The other thing that's cool about Germany is that, you know, you've got like Central Park in Berlin and people just go and there's a naked section and you just completely get naked. They have a very naked kind of culture and it's not weird. It's just the way it is.
Mm.
And it liberated me and I think it's awesome.
What an incredible experience.
It was. And if you are ever in Germany or Switzerland or anywhere where they do it, I highly recommend you go. You don't know anyone there, just do it.
Now, this brings up a really interesting point because oftentimes people ask me, how can I become more confident? And confident has so many different definitions and so forth. The way I define it as action something, even though you don't know the outcome, and even though the outcome might not go your way, don't internalize it, learn from it. So how can you use errors as adjustment schedules for your brain and body? This is exactly that. You're going into a situation which is highly uncomfortable, highly novel. So when, you know, doing something that you've never done before versus doing something that you've done many times, you're exposing yourself to a possible shame, possible everything, because your mind is going to be catastrophizing, but you push through it anyways. And, you know, there's all these, you know, memes and, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway, which I do agree with. But the question is how. You know, how do you push through that discomfort? How do you push through the biases that you have in your mind to say, don't do this, a bad thing is going to happen? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like giving a talk for the first time on stage. Your entire body is saying, don't do this, a bad thing is going to happen. Going at, you know, asking someone on a date, same thing. Don't do it, a bad thing is going to happen. You know, our nervous system essentially is trying to protect us. So my question to you is, I mean, you had your partner, your husband there, so you had that social support, but let's say if a person was completely on their own and they're hemming and hung, how do they get through that uncomfortable threshold to open that door and just bear all?
There is a plunge required, isn't there? There's a, and as I talked about, I realized that I didn't know many people, so I was kind of going, oh, how is this kind of becoming okay in my mind? If I don't like it, I can leave. You know, I had many kind of caveats that I was like, right, well, I can do this on these terms. And that's okay, I think, because sometimes just doing it and getting there is going to be the exposure therapy that we need. So instead of creating reasons why I ought not to do it, I was trying to kind of create reasons why it might help me feel comfy in the situation. I really believe it's, you know, in life, all we're doing is we're comfort zone expanding all the time, and you can either stay small and stay in your little comfort zone, but there's not much growth in that. Plus there's kind of like, you know, the fear of just staying the same for your whole life, and that's kind of a scary world in itself.
It petrifies me.
Yeah, staying the same, going to the same places, doing the same thing every single day. Ooh,
freaks me out.
Scary for me. So for me, it's kind of like this idea of I'm just pushing my comfort zone bit by bit. Mm-hmm. And so maybe for you, the idea of going to a knackered sauna is very intense. In which case you go, what's your knackered sauna experience? It's maybe it's going to a women's baths, and you don't have to be naked, but people are naked around you, and that could be an interesting experience. Or it's wearing a bikini, or maybe it's not wearing a bikini. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's actually being included in photos when your family get together, and actually just standing there and going, and you don't have to look at the photos. You just turn up and you get in it. And I think those little micro growth moments get us somewhere where we want to be.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be big, just tiny micro.
Yeah, there's a saying in Italian that I love. It's piano piano si va lontano, which means slowly, slowly, and you'll go a long way.
Fab.
And I love that. I love that. Now, my question to you now is, have you ever done something that has gone catastrophically wrong and that has almost, flung you into a state of, I don't know what I'm doing, and almost into a state of, I don't want to say depression, but you know, a state of feeling really low?
Oh, yeah, I have. I I think so often I've done things that are hard, and sometimes they go really well and sometimes they don't. I think, you know, when I started my business, there was very much a sense of who am I to be doing this?
Mm.
And I think, you know, this idea of imposter syndrome was definitely something for me where I was like, this dietitian, nutritionist, no one knows about, and I'm suddenly trying to do all these things, and who am I to be doing these things? And there are so many times that I've wanted to quit my job because I'm like, this, I don't understand why me? Especially when I started and I still had an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So I graduated from university, having gone to university because I had an eating disorder, right? I was like, I'm going to become a dietitian nutritionist because that way I'll have to be thin. People will only go and see me if I look like this. Therefore, this career will help me stay small. And so I went into dietetics with an eating disorder. I came out realizing that, hey, food's way more interesting than just calories in, calories out, weighing less. So I had to get my shit sorted. And so here I am in this kind of weird world and going, oh, I kind of have this disordered relationship with food, but I know this is the area that I want to go into. Who am I to be doing these things? I read this very interesting thing about imposter syndrome, though, and it kind of says, well, maybe it's not imposter syndrome. Maybe it's just that we have a culture that doesn't support women to actually feel like they deserve to take up space in this kind of world. Like we talked about, you know, men, you know, saying they can apply for a job where females can't. So maybe it isn't about us having imposter syndrome. Maybe it's about we've got to change that culture. Big ask.
Mm.
And I guess all that happened is with time, the imposter syndrome just kind of faded away. I could have quit, and I wanted to lots, many, many, many times. Once a month, I'd say. I had a really strong compulsion to quit.
Wow. But would something set you off to make you want to quit?
Yeah, like any a negative comment on social media, getting a no response, even just watching back something I'd done and thinking I was crappy. And honestly, I was kind of crappy, right? Everyone starts off crappy. That's the only way to get good is to practice and work through the crappiness. And so I think I'd see that and I'd beat myself up about it. But I think the fundamental thing is that I kind of didn't quit. I just kept going. And here we are almost 10 years later with a career that I really enjoy. And, you know, my husband works my business and we can kind of travel as much as we want and we have full flexibility and freedom. Had I quit after a few years of thinking I'm not good enough, I wouldn't have this right here.
It reminds me of that saying, you know, the people who are truly successful are not the ones that work hardest or the smartest or have the most money. It's simply the people that don't quit.
Mm. And sometimes there is a time to quit.
Mm. Mm,
there is a time to quit, but it's going to get hard and you are going to you're not going to be amazing, especially in the beginning. As I said, you're going to be crap. So if you're expecting perfection, whether it's in health or in how you turn up at work or how you turn up as a parent, if you're, you know, I think people have a very high standards of how they parent these days.
Mm.
I think we just got to let go of that perfectionism. Easier said than done, my friends.
Oy.
But whew, something to work on.
Mm. And speaking of comments, I think one media outlet had picked up a recent, I want to say, post or blog that you had written, and some of the comments that were in the comments section, go figure. You posted little snippets of them. They were like dagger through the heart kind of stuff.
Yeah, pretty severe stuff. So things like, why does she have a horse mouth? She really doesn't look like she should be a nutritionist. She's hardly the picture of health. I have a sudden urge to assassinate all Australian nutritionists, you know, that kind of rhetoric. You get the vibe.
Intense.
I also get people who are like, you know, you're too fat to be a nutritionist. I get people say you're too thin, I can't trust you. Yeah. I think I used to be quite sensitive about these comments. So I learned a few things. Firstly, don't read the comments section. Not a good place. I have a thick skin nowadays, so it honestly, it water off my back.
Yeah.
But I think that's the thing, is you don't really know me. Well, one person's horse's mouth is another one's beautiful smile, and I'm just going to ride the beautiful smile wave.
That's it. I always say that if a person doesn't know me enough to call me and ask me questions, then they don't know me well enough to make comments that I should essentially absorb and really consider. So I think that's my sort of litmus test. And the same thing when, you know, there's all these like, you know, news and this about stars and Hollywood people and so forth. And they say, oh, this person has had an affair on this. And I always, when people are talking about it, I said, well, do you know them? Do you know them enough to call them? Then how do you know whether that's true or not?
Mm.
I always essentially bite my tongue before trying to make an assessment about someone who really I don't know.
Love it. And you heard that quote, you could be the juiciest peach, but someone's not going to like peaches. You know, there are people who rated Harry Potter with one star saying it was terrible. Well, many of the people in the world loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I always think back to this time. My dad was watching Miss Universe, I think, you know, one of the beauty pageants. And the contestants were coming out. And he was finding fault in the different women's kind of bodies. And I don't think he was conscious that he was doing it. But it kind of struck me going, these are the most beautiful women in the world. And he's finding fault with these people. So honestly, when the bar is so out of control high, it's actually unattainable. Let's not try and reach that bar. And it was something, it was actually really sobering to realize that you can be perfect and still get a lot of hate. And it's actually just not your problem.
That's it. Now, speaking of your father, I do know that he has passed away.
Mm.
So I'm obviously very sorry about that. But how was your relationship with your dad throughout all your years of disordered eating? Did they know about it?
Yeah, so I lost my dad 2 years ago from quite a long, drawn-out cancer battle. Mm. It's only now getting to the point where I can kind of remember him as like a more vibrant version of himself because, you know, he was so sick for so long. So I kind of just still have that version where he was like skeletal and just so ill. But he was really vibrant, cool guy, flew airplanes and did stunts, was a professional water skier, cool things. My parents actually don't talk about this really often because I didn't really want to make it all about my family. But I think it's an interesting case study because, as I said, went to a nutritionist when I was 11, so obviously wasn't taking myself there. Was a normal weighted child and still got taken there. So it was kind of like their kind of preconceptions about what a girl should look like. And, you know, for them, they really wanted the best for me. And so, yeah, they were just trying to do what they thought I needed to do, which for them, they thought girls must look a certain way. And so I think, I think my parents were really always trying for me to weigh less. And I think there was a part of them that would have been okay with me doing really disordered things, provided that I was leaner. That was always the sense that I got. And I think a lot of people in society, though, it sounds crazy when I say it, my parents are okay with me doing disordered things, but we actually live in a world that's okay with us doing a lot of disordered things to our bodies. They're talked about in magazines, like it's okay. Most healthy eating advice or most diet advice is eating disorder advice.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't even realize it anymore.
Because it sells. If it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah, for sure. For my family, they were trying to give me every chance for success. But all it did is it fueled my eating disorder. It made me hide food. It made me eat in secret. It made me hate myself. It made me gain a lot of weight. Which is really the last thing they ever wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I felt like the biggest failure. You know, they had put so much time and money and energy into helping me lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
And here I was categorically obese, hating myself, out of control around food. And I reached a point where I realized after 10 years of a decade of yo-yo dieting, of trying really hard, I realized I knew so much about nutrition and health and what I should be eating. The problem's not knowing what to eat and what not to eat. It's all the nonsense, all this trying to control what I'm eating. That was the thing that was actually controlling me. And so I reached a point after 10 years where I'm like, you know what? What we've been doing, family, to try and control my weight is obviously backfiring. So whatever we're doing, we have to flip it and we reverse it. And so I had the conversation with them. I said, I know for years you've been trying to help me, but actually it's not helping me. And
wow. So sorry, I just need to stop there. So you actually had a conversation with your parents?
I lived with them. It was kind of essential because, you know, wow. Let's say I'd sit down and I'd eat a meal and they'd be like, well, you shouldn't be eating that. And as I talked about, you know, the carrot noodles when everyone else was eating spaghetti.
Yeah.
And so I explained, when everyone eats spaghetti, I have to eat spaghetti too, you know, and they think, but your weight's even more out of control than it's ever been. How does that make sense? And I said, you have to trust me here. Food is now my thing. I've got to take control of my food and you're not allowed to make comments on my weight anymore. You're not allowed to make comments about what I'm eating. Because obviously what we've been doing hasn't worked.
Wow. So when you were saying before about having those hard conversations, you've had the hardest conversation.
Yeah, it was hard. And what's hard about it is they don't get it. And they don't trust you because you've got this unused track record of not having control around food.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, how are you going to do it by yourself?
Tough.
Yeah. Wow. But I had to remind many a time, come back with, we had the conversation, this is what I need from you. And they're like, well, whatever. And they get angry about it or they get sad about it or they, you know, tell me off about it. But I kind of at that point just had a barrier up, like I'm protecting myself here because I don't want this life for myself. That's when I kind of discovered intuitive eating and, you know, a new way of thinking about food and decided that if it took me 10 more years to create a healthy relationship with my body and food, but I never had to like worry about calories or anything, it would have been so worth it. So whereas before I was like, you got 3 months to make this happen.
Yeah.
You got to get fit by the end of the year, you know, nonsense like that. I didn't give myself a timeline about when I need to achieve it. All I knew is that I didn't want to get to 80 years old and lie in bed at night thinking about what I ate that day. And so for me, it was 10 years of dieting. I speak to many people. It's 20, 30, 40, 50 years already that they've been dieting. And to you, I say, there's still time. You can still kind of go, well, I don't want to be 80 lying in bed thinking about what I've eaten. So you can still turn things around.
The saying I go by is if you're still breathing, there's still time to change.
Mm-hmm.
But man, I have literally goosebumps all over my body because that to me is very significant. Because if, and I don't want to compare your parents to lions, but if you're looking at the tiger or lion in the eye, sometimes that's how we can make peace.
Mm.
You know, it's understanding their point of view. That's mind blowing to me because they, as you said, they wanted you to do well. I don't think they were doing this out of spite.
No. And what you have to know is I'm very close with my parents.
Yeah. And I was going to ask, how did that affect your relationship moving on?
Well, now my mom will say, I'm so sorry. We didn't know. We really thought we were doing the best by you. You have to know that. We just didn't know how. That's how we were raised doing it. And so in a way, I became their teacher about this is the way we need to start thinking about food. And it sucks that the child has to become the parent, but you know what? It can happen. And think about your parents who taught you a lot. Maybe there's some stuff that you could teach them. We have a great relationship. There is mutual respect. And I loved my dad and miss my dad. And he went to, he died being very proud of me and holding up my book very, you know, proudly. And
I remember that.
Yeah, such a sweetheart. So, no, I think it's because we had very open and honest conversations. I didn't, you know, not like he died with me being angry with him.
God, that's beautiful. I remember when seeing your dad, the first thing I did was call my dad. makes you just look at the world in a different way. And I think that this is what, to me, this episode is providing people a way to look at what they're doing. Yes, we spoke around eating and exercise, but I don't think that there's a barrier or boundary to this. It's really about approaching the uncomfortable, especially with those people that you think will just not understand. And I think what you're saying is they may not understand at first, but perseverance is a key here.
Mm.
If you really want something, if you've hit that threshold in your life to say, you know what, I can't go on like this. And that's where I was at. I can't go on like this. This is mashugan nuts.
Mm.
Absolutely crazy. I cannot do this anymore. And something's got to give. And I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah. It's sad that we have to reach that breaking point, but sometimes you do.
So If you could leave us with perhaps a nugget of your essentially boundless, limitless wisdom, what would that be? What is one challenge that you would like people to consider to take home and actually do? I'm all about action rather than thinking, what can they do?
Yeah. You know, there's this quote that it always comes back to me, which is, be healthy, but don't give up 95% of your life to weigh 5% less. I mean, I keep coming back to it because I'm like, it's fundamental to everything I do and everything who I am. I think there are lots of practical things that I'd like you to do, and we talked about many of those in here. One of the things I think is really useful is to start to write down your thoughts around food. Okay, so just spend one day, one meal. I mean, whatever you can do, my friend, do it. Note section on your phone, pen and paper, whatever kind of person you are, and just start writing down what you're thinking around food. It doesn't have to be, don't like try and control it. What you're going to notice is just how many thoughts probably come into your head. And I speak to so many people who are like, oh no, I don't diet. I'm just trying to eat healthily. And then I'll chat to them a little more and I'm like, oh, no, you still have a whole bunch of food rules. So you're not on an Atkins diet or the keto diet, but you are dieting. So, so you got to get clear on what are all these food rules that are clouding your brain. Things like breakfast is the most important meal of the day. You have to have 6 more meals to keep your metabolism going. You have to have 3 main meals to have your metabolism going. Don't have carbohydrates. This is fattening. That, you know, write it all down. I reckon you get a pretty hefty list. Now, if we want to kind of get healthy around food, what we got to start doing is working through eliminating these food rules so that everything truly is allowed. Especially if you're a binge eater, especially if you're an emotional eater, you got to do this exercise. You got to get clear on where you're at the moment. And then I think we can start making magic.
All right, guys. So you've heard it from the lady herself. Get out those pens and paper, get out the notes section. Fart out your thoughts, like I say. You know, it's almost like turning on a water tap, and don't stop writing until it's dry. And then perhaps looking at one rule that pops up that really resonates with you that maybe you just want to throw out.
And just one rule at a time. And then, you know, just work this week on getting rid of this rule. And however long, once you've lost that rule, work on the next one. And as I said, there are the fear, if I let go of these rules are the things that keep me looking a certain way. If I get rid of them, I'm going to gain weight. I'm going to go out of control with food. The paradox is that the opposite is what ends up happening. I know that's a leap of faith you've got to take. But if you're kind of listening to this podcast, chances are you're not feeling super happy with your relationship with food anyhow. So it's a risk worth taking.
Definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Mm-hmm. So from the great words of George Costanza, do the opposite and magical things will happen. Lindy, it's been an absolute pleasure today, and I'm sure we're going to turn off the mics and then keep on chatting. But thank you so much. It's just been an absolute honor to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me. So good.
Lots of love. I hope you loved every bit of that podcast as much as I did. How smooth is Lindy's voice, eh? Many of you have graciously asked how you can support the podcast. The best way is to first subscribe, and secondly, share with a friend or a family member that you believe might benefit from the information. It really is a terrific way to digitally show you care, and from my heart to yours, I really appreciate it. Thanks again for your time and interest in the Secrets in the City podcast. Until next time, never forget that every day is your chance to shine.